This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Now let's watch as they move the ball around until Big Jim Neal gets position on Mikan.
That sound from the 1954 NBA Finals. The players look as if they're moving in slow motion.
Finally, Mickelson, the third man, grabs the ball and it's a field goal for Minneapolis.
A few months after that game, the 24-second clock would be adopted by the NBA. Some say it saved the league. Our story begins with that clock and the man everyone believed developed it. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Danny Biasone was 83 years old on the day in 1992 when Sean Kirst, then a columnist for the Syracuse Post-Standard, came to visit him.
Danny was this tiny, indomitable force. When I met him, he was 2 weeks before death. He was in his bowling alley, which had remained unchanged since the days when he owned the Nats.
Biasone owned the Syracuse Nationals from 1946 to 1963, and he owned that bowling alley back then, too. The story Kirst had heard, the story everyone had heard, was that after a game one night, Danny Biasone scribbled calculations on the back of a napkin at the bar of his bowling alley and invented the 24-second clock. Kirst says Biasone never talked about the clock. He always called it the time.
He said that the game had become tedious and no one wanted to watch it because if one team got up by 10 points, they'd just stall the ball for the rest of the game. Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time. So he never said, I came up with this idea.
Biasone didn't have to say he came up with the idea. Legendary Celtics executive Red Auerbach said it for him. Danny Biasone invented the 24-second clock by himself alone, Kirst quoted Auerbach as saying. I was at the meeting when he introduced it. He should get all the credit in the world for it.
So I wrote about that, and I get a call out of the blue from a woman who is very upset, who says to me, my husband was instrumental in creating the clock, and no one remembers him and no one believes it. And she was so upset. I wondered if it was for real. Some of my colleagues said that she had called before, and people sort of, to put this harshly, people kind of wrote her off as a crackpot.
Ever since he was a kid, Kirst had studied early basketball history, so the woman's claims got his attention.
I said, okay, Mrs. Ferris, I'll come out and talk to you. So I go out to this house in North Syracuse where this really gracious, wonderful person greets me. Tells me that her husband is dying of Huntington's and can't speak for himself.
Leo Ferris had a fatal genetic disorder. Some have said it's like dying of Alzheimer's, ALS, and Parkinson's all at the same time.
She brings out a paper bag and says, here's the clippings. And it's a paper grocery bag. And I start going through it, and in maybe a quarter of the way through, I pull out a newspaper that shows Leo Ferris with Ned Irish and these other giants of basketball in 1949 at the instant at which the NBA was created. It blew my doors off. It was like, holy smokes. And I had no clue. I apologized. I apologized on behalf of myself, and I apologized on behalf of all of the basketball hierarchy that had forgotten her husband and had disregarded her. I said, you know, you're right, and we're going to do something about this. And this thing really became more than just journalism to me. It became a quest for justice, historic justice, for this remarkable family that had been totally overlooked unfairly.
Around the same time, nearly 2,000 miles away, Christian Figueroa was growing up in Puerto Rico. Like many of his friends, he loved playing and watching basketball. One day, before he was 10 years old,
I was watching a basketball game. TV. It was definitely involving Michael Jordan, the Bulls. And my mother turned the corner and she started to watch the game with me. And she said, oh, do you know my Uncle Leo invented the shot clock? And I was like, what? Really? You never told me that.
Figueroa knew that his mother had been raised in upstate New York, but this was the first time she had mentioned her Uncle Leo, who was, of course, Leo Ferris. From then on, whenever she would catch her son watching an NBA game on TV, she'd share another story of her uncle and his connections with the league.
And, you know, I'd go to school and I'd say, hey, well, my great uncle invented the 24-second shot clock. And they'd turn around, my friends, and say, yeah, well, my grandmother invented the three-point line. And they just wouldn't believe me. And so I remember at an early age being frustrated by my lack of proof.
During the summers, Figueroa visited his mother's family in upstate New York, and that's where he met his Aunt Beverly, Leo's wife. She'd come to family reunions and bring an envelope filled with old photos and newspaper clippings. Figueroa hung on her every word. It must have been a relief for Beverly Ferris to find such a receptive audience. Leo was growing weaker by the day. Along with her daughter Jamie, Beverly provided all of Leo's care at home. And she still hadn't found anyone other than journalist Sean Kirst, who believed her.
She fought many years, even when he was still alive, even when her daughter was getting sick. She fought and fought to get the truth out. I can't even imagine how difficult that must have been for her.
Decades later, Christian Figueroa would pick up where his great aunt left off. Meanwhile, Sean Kirst was digging into the stories Beverly Ferris had told him, finding corroboration the best way he knew how.
Sitting with a lever at a microfilm machine in the back room of a library and reading clips and just going day by day and reading the things, because in the old days they reported everything.
Kirst says if not for Leo Ferris, the NBA as we know it might never have been formed. Back in the 1940s, there were two rival pro basketball leagues. The NBL, founded in 1937, played in mostly smaller cities, and the BAA, which came along to challenge the NBL in 1946. Ferris was the co-founder and GM of an NBL team, the Buffalo, later Tri-State Bisons. Ferris and the other NBL executives knew their league couldn't survive if it had to compete with the BAA, so...
So they make him president of the NBL with the mission to be force a merger with the BAA.
Leo Ferris did what smart league presidents do. He outbid the BAA for the best players coming out of college. But then he came up with a crazy idea. Why settle for signing one college player at a time when he could sign a whole college team?
Kentucky had a team that they called the Fabulous Five, and he creates a franchise for them. He says, if you guys come to our league, you can have the Indianapolis franchise. It'll be your team. That is the move that broke the BAA's back. They say, okay, that's enough.
That old black and white photo Beverly Ferris showed Sean Kirst on that afternoon back in 1992 was taken on August 3rd, 1949, the day the two leagues merged to form the NBA. Five men stand smiling, their hands stacked on top of each other. Ferris is in the middle. His left hand rests on the top of the pile.
So you can argue that if a meteor had fell on Leo at that moment, he should be in basketball's Hall of Fame. But he doesn't stop there. That's what's so cool.
Sean Kirst had gotten at least one thing absolutely right in his story about Syracuse Nats owner / bowling alley operator Danny Biasone.
Danny said something had to change. You had to have a change in the time.
The idea of a shot clock was already out there, but how much time should be on it? Leo Ferris did the math. By 1954, he was the general manager of Biasone's team. Looking over box scores from games that had been hard-fought and exciting, he and Biasone counted an average of 120 shots, roughly 60 by each team. It was Leo Ferris who took pen to napkin at the bowling alley bar. The game is 48 minutes long. 48 minutes equals 2,880 seconds. Divide that by 120 and you've got the 24-second shot clock. Leo Ferris, not Danny Biasone, presented the clock to the Rules Committee meeting. All of this is documented in old newspaper clippings.
Just to give you the importance of this thing, Bill Himmelman, the NBA historian for many years, once said, there are two moments of importance in basketball history. There's the moment when Dr. Naismith nails a peach basket to the wall, and there's the moment when they turn on the 24-second clock.
Leo's role in all of this, the shot clock, the formation of the NBA, and more, was thoroughly reported in the Post-Standard and other newspapers of the day. So why, when Beverly Ferris called the sports desk 40 years later, did no one believe her story?
He did all this before he was even 39 years old. He left the game at 38 years old.
That was just months after the shot clock was introduced. Christian Figueroa says it would take decades before anyone realized the importance of the things Leo Ferris had done.
By then, he was sick, and by then, he was decades out of the game, and by then, history had been rewritten, frankly.
Leo Ferris died in 1993 after a 25-year battle with Huntington's disease. Beverly Ferris died in 2010 without seeing her husband recognized for his achievements. Leo and Beverly's daughter, Jamie, also inherited Huntington's. Figueroa visited her before her death in 2014.
And even as all her muscle functions were deteriorating, she still would talk about him. She would come alive when she got to talk about Leo. When she passed in 2014, it got me thinking about another family member passed, another family member who knew Leo, another family member that had fought for Leo.
Not every family would have fought so hard. Some might have felt that Leo's post-NBA career in real estate was enough evidence of a life well lived. But for Beverly and Jamie, recognition was everything. By the time his cousin died, Christian Figueroa had a son of his own, a son who loved basketball. And Figueroa decided it was his turn to pick up the fight to set straight his family's legacy.
So this is for Leo, for Aunt Beverly, this is for cousin Jamie, and for all the people who suffer and have suffered from Huntington's disease.
And while the Basketball Hall of Fame hasn't recognized Leo Ferris yet, Sean Kirst says it's just a matter of time.
How could any fair person hearing our conversation here today, how could you say, you know, that he doesn't belong in there? That this thing is happening, that a great nephew in Boston embraces the cause of this forgotten upstate basketball pioneer, it's just a joyous story, and I hope it has a joyous culmination.
Since our story first aired, Christian Figueroa and the other champions of Leo Ferris have had some success. Last October, Leo Ferris was inducted into the Greater Syracuse Hall of Fame. Christian Figueroa says that the induction ceremony was lovely and attended by more than 1,000 people, including many members of Ferris's family and even some of Beverly Ferris's former co-workers. But just last weekend, Leo Ferris was once again left off the list of Basketball Hall of Fame inductees. It's the third year in a row that Ferris was nominated and not inducted. Our story was produced and reported by Only a Game's Karen Given. After an influx of Somali refugees to Lewiston, Maine, the city's high school soccer team was divided.
I told them that for us to be a team, we had to practice together. We had to play together this way. We couldn't be one group and another group.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. It's time for three stories you should know.
This tournament tonight, the Nova Nation has another national championship.
Villanova has won its second men's basketball title in just 3 years, and this week we're going to start with one last March Madness story, and then we'll move on to baseball. I'm joined by the Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and by Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, Bill.
Hello there.
Rachel, I understand you are speculating about future NCAA tournaments and where they'll be, right?
Yes, indeed. Everybody loves San Antonio as a Final Four spot. People just absolutely raved about it there, the Riverwalk, the warm weather. So, of course, it looks like the Final Four very well might not be back there. The Alamo Dome is going up against a wave of new super stadiums that are really taking precedent in terms of big neutral site events. The college football playoff has already said, we're not going to play there. There's not enough suites and hospitality areas to entertain clients. So it's very possible that the Final Four will travel to these mega stadiums in Atlanta and Minnesota and soon in LA and not go back to the fan favorite of San Antonio.
Craig, are you dismayed by this news?
I'm mostly confused. This is college sports we're talking about, right? And my understanding is that this is amateur competition and it's all for the love of the game and the education and edification of young people. So I'm not understanding this whole need for corporate suites and sponsors and clients. Where does that come into college basketball?
Mm-hmm. This world of yours frightens and confuses me. That's your position?
You obviously have not spent much time around college sports, Craig.
Yeah, it's about the cash, obviously. Everything is about the money, especially in amateur, would-be amateur athletics these days. And as someone who lives in Columbus, Ohio, where there happens to be a college football team of note, I can tell you that the notion that there's any amateurism to this at all is rather silly, and they're not going to be going back to the Palestra in Philly, for example, which would be a wonderful place to see a college basketball championship.
Absolutely.
But such is the way of the world.
Well, the phenomenon of the arms race as it applies to buildings and facilities related to games is not new. I guess what we're seeing is just the most recent sort of supercharged manifestation of it. Or, Rachel, is there something more to this? Is it a phenomenon we haven't seen before?
I think you're right. This really is just the next step in the never-ending escalation. I do think that this will basically indicate to us what the NCAA's priorities are. Remember, this is the cash cow of the entire organization. More than 80% of the NCAA's annual revenues come from this tournament, mainly from media rights, but certainly all the rest is important too. So if it does indeed decide, and the decision will be made in the summer, not to go back to San Antonio, I think that'll be a reflection in part of the economics.
Greg, what's on your mind?
The weather. Everybody talks about the weather, but no one does anything about it.
I can't believe you said that.
But we should. Maybe we should, because the baseball season is underway, and it's been underway a little over a week now. And I think Thursday's games were the first set of games that didn't have at least one or two rainouts or snowouts or coldouts. A lot of people are upset about this, and a big reason for it is because the Major League Baseball season has gotten underway about a week earlier than it normally does for a number of reasons, mostly dealing with the new collective bargaining agreement. So we got going in March instead of April, and Mother Nature has wreaked havoc on us. And as this usually does occur, and I remember 2010 or 2011, we had the same sort of situation happen. There are people wondering why we don't start the season later, or why we don't start every game in a southern or domed city, or why don't they have domes in Yankee Stadium, for example? Why can't we build a retractable roof on Fenway Park, you know, sort of aftermarket retractable roof? People get crazy when the games start to get rained out early in the season. And my general take on it is, it's the weather. We always get the games in. Let's relax.
Well, I do find it funny that this is sort of like the dome's revenge, right? Because they've pretty much all but disappeared. The enclosed, multi-purpose cookie-cutter domes like the King Dome, the Astrodome, and in my hometown of Minneapolis, the Metrodome. Mm-hmm. But as we're learning, there were huge upsides to them as well, such as that you could go see a game in the snow. By the way, they're also good when it's too hot outside. When it was sweltering and humid in Minneapolis, we always knew it was going to be 70 degrees in the Metrodome.
I have long maintained that the seasons are too long, and that's easy for me to say because, unlike team owners and TV executives, my income doesn't depend on the length of the baseball season or the hockey season or whatever. But probably Kevin Kiermaier agrees with me. He's the Rays player who said that he would smear his body with Vaseline before the Rays played in New York on a 40-degree day with 20-degree wind chill factors. And he didn't do it, but he brought up a good point. And I wish he had done it, because maybe baseball would have paid attention and thought about an actual baseball season instead of maximizing profits by beginning playing when it's still winter in New England. And I'm finished, and get off my lawn.
I don't know, Craig, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't baseball sort of frown on players bringing Vaseline into the games?
Only if they're pitchers. Well, outfielders can do it.
Well, pitchers can actually use sunscreen. They have no problem with sunscreen. A lot of them use that to, they claim anyway, to make sure they get the proper grip on the ball. You know, it's one of those things that if you're doing it in secret, it's terrible. But if you're telling everyone you're doing it, it's totally fine.
All right, it's my turn, and I want to talk about this rookie that the Angels have got, although he's not really a rookie because he's played several years in Japan. Shohei Ohtani began the season very well in his first at-bat for the Angels' home opener. He hit home run, added a couple of singles. They won the game 13-2, and he's a pitcher. Or perhaps I should say he's also a pitcher. He's the first player since 1973 to start a game as a pitcher and homer in another game as a designated hitter. And everybody knows pitchers can't hit. It's the first thing you learn about baseball. Is this guy a freak, or have we been misunderstanding baseball entirely for all these years, and are there pitchers who can hit all over the place?
I don't think it's necessarily that pitchers can't hit. It's that I would assume most teams don't want them to, because everything is geared around protecting that arm, and you don't want a guy with a 142 batting average, or even a better one, to ruin his throwing arm. One thing that's really interesting about Otani, if I'm right, he bats left and throws right, whereas Babe Ruth, who of course famously, about 100 years ago, did the same thing, pitched and hit. He threw and batted left. And I bring this up because I theorize, and I hope this is true, that Otani can sort of balance out the mechanics and maybe hang on for longer than Ruth did. Because I think Ruth only pitched and hit for about a season and a few other times. He didn't do it for his entire career.
Yeah, he became so valuable as a hitter that the Yankees wanted to use him every day. And I can see that, and I can see why somebody playing every day might not be ready to start on the mound every fifth day or whatever it might be. But this guy's no 142 hitter. I mean, he hit over 300 in the Japanese League and won 15 games a season. It is quite astonishing, I think.
I think he's a freak. He's a wonderful freak. I think the biggest question is, will Angels manager Mike Scioscia continue to give Otani days off? If he continues to hit, there's going to be a heavy temptation to stick him in the DH every single day that he's not pitching. And then you got to wonder what's going to happen when he pitches. Or even more so, there is a possibility of an American League manager to just forego the DH altogether and have his pitcher hit. You could do that in the American League. It's
sure,
a choice. It's only
sure.
been done about five or six times in the last 40 years of the DH. But Mike Scioscia could do it.
You know, you've pointed out, Craig, several good reasons to watch baseball, or at least watch the Angels this season. And I think another good reason might be just to see if one or two pitchers on every team in baseball emerges out of the bullpen and says to the manager, hey, you know, I hit about 450 in high school. Put me in. I can do you some good here.
There's a wonderful record of starting pitchers who think they can hit. And one is Justin Verlander of the Houston Astros, who is an atrocious hitter whenever he's had to in his career, which hasn't been very often. But he talks a big game to the press and in the locker room. He tells everyone he's a great hitter. These guys are the most deluded athletes on the planet.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks to both of you.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Subscribe to Only a Game on your favorite podcast app, and while you're at it, leave us a review. We love to chuckle at the silly usernames you come up with, and it really does help other listeners find our show.
When I was in Lewiston, it felt like its better days were in the rearview mirror.
Amy Bass was in Lewiston, Maine to attend Bates College, and there wasn't much reason to stay after she graduated in 1992.
A lot of unemployment, a lot of vacancy. Things that Maine deals with in terms of younger population moving away.
But Bass became intrigued with Lewiston a little under 20 years ago when she learned about an influx of families from Somalia.
So a lot of these folks were coming from other refugee relocation sites, particularly in the outskirts of Atlanta. They didn't want big city life. They wanted space for larger families. They wanted security and safety, and they wanted good schools.
And at first it looked like a good fit. Lewiston certainly had the space, vacant apartments and storefronts. Mainers didn't have much experience with refugees, but if people wanted to move to Lewiston and help repopulate the place, why should anybody object? Until they did, or one of them did, and he was the mayor of Lewiston, Larry Raymond. In October of 2002, he wrote an open letter to the growing Somali community in town.
It was written on city stationery, although it wasn't really an official city declaration, saying that the Somali community that has already come is supported and welcomed, and they were done, and to please tell friends and relatives to stop coming.
The letter was fine with some of Lewiston's residents, the ones who'd heard that the Somalis had been drawn to town by Maine's welfare system. Rumors had circulated suggesting that the schools had become overcrowded, that the city had been buying cars for the Somalis, that the new arrivals were getting benefits to which longtime residents were not entitled. Somebody scrawled, "Go back to Africa," on a mirror in a school bathroom. But members of the Somali community answered Mayor Raymond's letter with one of their own. They pointed out that they were working and buying groceries and otherwise contributing to the community. And then there was soccer. Mike McGraw, who'd been teaching biology and coaching the boys' high school soccer team in Lewiston for decades, saw opportunity in the new arrivals.
Well, they weren't from Maine, and I knew that the rest of the world played the game where the United States kind of just used it as a recreation.
Lewiston was a hockey town. After that, it was a football town. Basketball matters a lot in Maine. Mike McGraw was a respected coach whose soccer teams had posted winning seasons, but they'd never won it all. And then along came these Somali kids. Some of them had lost family members while being chased from one refugee camp to another, but wherever they'd gone, they'd kicked around balls made of cardboard and cloth. They had skills, even if they were not entirely game-ready, or more precisely, ready for Coach McGraw.
I recall one of the kids saying, after a summer game, he says, "Well, when am I going to get a uniform?" And I said, "Well, you have to try out." He says, "Try out? Why try out? I'm good enough. We're going to be a champion." And I said, "Let's try out first and see what happens."
Soon, Mike McGraw faced another challenge. What would he tell the white players who'd expected to be starters, or at least to make the team, and the white parents who'd shared that expectation? McGraw pointed out to them that it was the Somali kids who'd gathered in the parking lot outside the hockey arena after the season's first snowfall because they knew it was the first place that would be plowed, the first place where they could kick a ball around.
It's pretty easy. If you practice, you play. If you don't practice, you sit and watch. Nothing personal, it's just the way the game is played.
Okay, so far, the composition of the players trying out doesn't change the ethics of the veteran coach, who eventually gets some help from a Somali assistant coach named Abdi Jabbar Hirsi. Here's his son, Bilal.
My dad, when he first came, he didn't really like the American style, you can say. Like, in basically in Europe and places, other places, they like to play more passing and more, like, skillful soccer. And I'm glad Coach McGraw and my dad, like, talked, and they helped change the way that Lewiston soccer was played.
Still, building a team from two disparate groups was a challenge, even though McGraw says the white players understood that the skilled Somalis would help their team get better. The coach recalls one particular afternoon when the white kids were hanging around together waiting for practice to start. Down the hill from the field, the Somali kids were kicking a ball around. It must have looked as if two teams were getting ready to play against each other.
And I told them that for us to be a team, this is how we had to be. We had to practice together. We had to play together this way. We couldn't be one group and another group. And that we needed to learn how to trust and work together with each other. And I mentioned that this is also maybe a good way to be in the hallways at the school and to get to know each other and maybe interact with each other, go to the movies and things like that. We were pretty good before, but that's when we started to get a lot better.
Did the Somalis learn to like Maine blueberry preserves? Coach McGraw didn't say, but he mentioned that lots of folks in Lewiston began trying sambusa, which the coach asked Bilal to define.
It's like this tortilla, but it's like filled with whatever you want. It can be chicken, it can be meats or anything like that. And a lot of people in our town really, really like that.
By 2015, about a decade and a half after the Somalis had started making their homes in Lewiston and sharing their cuisine, a lot of people in the town also really, really liked the soccer team McGraw had built into a contender for the state championship.
There was no doubt in my mind that we were going to get there. And then it was just a matter of playing the game the way we're supposed to play.
The Somali families had continued to arrive in Lewiston. As time passed, they had veteran Somali players to help them get used to shin guards, whistles, and referees, as well as the rest of the new culture. Still, one of McGraw's players told him that on July 4th, his mother had hustled him indoors to hide because she was sure that war had broken out. So, adjustments. But in 2015, Mike McGraw had a team that had excited the city and made it to the game that would decide the state champion.
4,500 people were at that game, more people that went to the state championship football game that year.
And then, despite the fact that Lewiston had built a reputation as a high-scoring team, the final settled into a scoreless battle. McGraw had to be concerned. One mistake or a fluke bounce could lead to the kind of disappointment that he'd often experienced. But the coach says he wasn't worried.
I had supreme confidence in our kids. Even when it got down towards the latter part of the game, when it looked like it was going to be a tie, it didn't matter to me. I knew that we were going to play well enough somehow to break through.
A throw-in landed in the middle of the penalty area and bounced toward the far post.
And one of the players from Scarborough didn't judge the flight of the ball, and it glanced off his thigh and went in. It was an own goal. And, you know, it's like everybody says, we'll take it.
The Blue Devils hang on for the 1-0 victory, the first championship for the Blue Devils in high school soccer.
The community celebrated. And it was a community that high school soccer had helped to build and sustain, which, according to Amy Bass, is what makes the story she found when she returned to Lewiston more than a sports story.
They had ownership of a really important part of Lewiston history, the city's first state championship in soccer. And as one former player says from the stands that day, it was a wee moment. And I think that amidst all of the celebration, the trophy moving throughout town and a community dinner and national media attention, everything comes together in that 90 minutes of that game. It doesn't mean that they're going to stay together. Community is still really hard work. But now they know what it feels like. They had that day of knowing what it feels like to be together, to bleed blue, as they say. And they say that once you bleed blue, you always will in Lewiston.
The Lewiston boys soccer team won another state championship in 2017. Bilal Hersey played for that team. We'll have a link to Amy Bass's book, One Goal, at onlyagame.org. Erin Reagan played soccer in college and briefly in the pros. She was a goalkeeper, the last line of defense.
It takes an immense amount of bravery. I love that. I love being the hero. I love being the underdog.
That came in handy when the Pro League Erin was playing for Folded. That story's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, you think you're a dedicated fan? When was the last time you sang through an entire game all by yourself? But first, it's time for my conversation about the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill. I think any time that I would sing through an entire game, I probably wouldn't remember it the next day.
And you probably would be all by yourself by the end of the game. It's Masters weekend in Augusta, and nobody better shout dilly dilly or mashed potatoes or they'll be thrown right out of there. Are these considered profanities at Augusta?
Well, first of all, dilly dilly's from that stupid beer commercial, okay?
As opposed to the smart beer commercials?
Well, there have been smart beer commercials. Not many, but some. The Elaine May and Mike Nichols cartoons
Excellent.
For Narragansett back in the
Good
day
point.
Were smart commercials. In any event, I don't know why people yell mashed potatoes. I mean, why not?
They're hungry.
Well, maybe, but, you know, why not zucchini or, you know, sweet potato pie? Or
what happens if somebody shouts, go on, throw me out, you humorless golf policeman, you?
The humorless golf police at Augusta will come and throw them out because that's what they're doing.
Sergio Garcia, who entered the Masters as the defending champion, finished Thursday's round with a new record, an octuple bogey 13 on the 15th hole. That's not what a good record.
The ball
is
not supposed to go in the water that often.
Five
I don't
times.
Know much about golf, but I know it's not supposed to go in the water five times in one hole.
It has been said, of course, that golf isn't really a sport and that golfers aren't as tough as, say, football players or lacrosse players, whatever. Nobody better try telling that to Tony Finau, I guess.
He hit a hole-in-one, which is a great thing at the Masters. It's a great thing anywhere, but it's a really great thing at the Masters. And he was so happy, he jumped up in the air and wrecked his ankle.
Yes. Now
and
this
went
was,
and played anyway.
This was at the par 3 course the day before the actual Masters began.
Right.
He should have been in the hospital.
Yes, except that he popped his ankle back into place, and I don't even like to think about that.
There's video of that, and I don't even want to watch it.
So be careful when you celebrate.
Next year, in the week preceding the Masters, Augusta National will host the final round of a women's amateur event. Is that the sound of various ancient and august Augusta chairmen spinning in their respective graves?
Creeping slowly up on the 20th century is our favorite American golf course.
Villanova is the best men's basketball team in the nation. They're the champs. You saw them achieve that distinction on Monday night in San Antonio. Were you impressed?
They're the best men's college basketball team I've seen in maybe 20 years.
Wow.
They're that good, yeah. And this was a coronation. I mean, nobody came close to them in the tournament.
The women's tournament did not go as you and I were sure it would go.
For the second year in a row, I might add.
We learned nothing.
Absolutely.
We're still employed. It's quite remarkable. That was courtesy of Erike Ogunbowale. She secured each of Notre Dame's final two games with last-second shots. I would say this is the stuff of fiction, but no self-respecting fiction writer could get it past his editor.
No, Villanova was the unquestioned star of the men's Final Four, but the men's Final Four could not hold a candle to the women's Final Four, which was completely insane.
Yeah.
Not only did, once again, we stumble over our UConns, but the last shot that won the championship was a ridiculous jump shot. fading sideways from the corner and well defended.
And no doubt in the world and that it was going to go in.
I don't think the net even moved.
Right. Gabe Kapler is the rookie manager of the Philadelphia Phillies, and he has managed to make quite a few mistakes during his first week on the job. Last Saturday, he signaled to the bullpen for a relief pitcher before calling the bullpen to tell somebody to warm up, and I understand the league was not amused.
No, I like Gabe Kapler a great deal, but his first couple weeks as the manager of the Phillies and in a sports town not noted for his patience has not been good.
I was reminded of another time when something like this happened. It was in the early days of the Mets when Casey Stengel was managing and he went out and signaled for a reliever and the door to the bullpen remained closed and Stengel watched for a while and then turned to the pitcher who he was removing and said, "They're all afraid to come out." Henrik and Daniel Sedin have played their entire NHL careers for the Vancouver Canucks, and they announced this week that they will be retiring together at the end of the season. They're 37. They're twins. Who can be surprised that they got tired at the
same
time?
It's a great story. And I am so I'm happy they played their entire career for one team. I'm happy they played their entire careers with each other. And now they're going to go out together, and that's just great.
A Nashville Predators fan was dismayed when the NHL's Situation Room overturned a last-second game-tying goal for the Preds on Tuesday night. So she did what any self-respecting Predators fan would do, right?
Yes, the Predators fans, they throw catfish on the ice.
Sure.
Which are big sucker fish, by the way. You got to really have an arm to get a catfish all the way down from Section 309 to the ice surface. So Briley Meeks didn't like the call, so she sent a couple of catfish to the NHL offices.
Ooh.
She sealed up the fish in a cooler. And inside the cover of the cooler, once you opened up, were the words, "You suck."
Ah. Have a fish. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game, of course. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Not every athlete is as lucky as Henrik and Daniel Sedin have been, retiring at 37 after accomplishing pretty much everything there is to accomplish in their sport. Most athletes have to hang them up sooner than that, and those athletes, if they're really lucky, will find something in their playing career that leads them to a completely different post-playing career. Gwendolyn Oxenham brings us one of those stories.
Welcome, everyone, to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California.
On July 10th, 1999, 17.9 million people tuned in to the Women's World Cup final.
And now it comes down to this compelling matchup between China and the U.S.
The game was sold out, more than 90,000 screaming fans filling the stadium. Aaron Reagan, a sophomore on Wake Forest University's soccer team, was one face in the crowd.
It was magical. It was so awesome to see women at that highest level, at the highest point of victory. I'm getting chills talking about it.
Mia Hamm going against the sea of red. Still going.
They were living the dream that all of us think about and that you didn't know that girls could do. And that's when you kind of go, this is real. I can do this.
The United States has won the Women's World Cup.
I mean, I'll remember it forever.
The hope was that that incredible moment in time and the fervor it generated could sustain a professional league where hundreds of women could make a living playing the game. In 2000, WUSA, the first women's pro league, was born. 3 years later, Erin Reagan got a chance to play. She was a goalkeeper, the last guard.
It takes an immense amount of bravery. You're throwing your head, your teeth, your eyeballs in front of someone's foot, in front of a ball. I always want to save the day, and goalkeeper is, that's the position. I love that. I love being the hero. I love being the underdog.
Erin made the roster of the Washington Freedom, home of Mia Hamm, Abby Wambach. She was a rookie, a backup. But right at the beginning of the season, the starting keeper was out, which meant Erin got the start.
I'm just like, I'm just this nobody who is now in net, the last line of defense for Mia Hamm and Abby Wambach. And I remember just being on edge. I was just electric.
Erin stopped two breakaways and made diving save after diving save, and her team won.
And so we were in like the little locker room area or whatever, and they had a vending machine that had Gatorade or something. And Mia Hamm came up to me and she said, hey, you played really good out there today. I was just floored. I mean, it was just the poster child for women's soccer who is in a Gatorade commercial. I can see the machine. I can see the spot. I can see her face. It was surreal.
Erin's team, the Washington Freedom, ended up winning the whole shebang, league champions.
Abby Wambach, she won a car for being the MVP. We all got Tiffany rings. They pulled out all the stops. It felt like a real championship win, so it was super cool.
Erin went home for the offseason. A couple of weeks passed.
And then we got word that the league had folded and that it was up in the air of whether or not it would come back and in what form and when.
In the United States, some 1.4 million girls play organized soccer and 32,000 women play in college. But after three seasons, the Pro League had gone bust financially. And the kids and teenagers who had watched that World Cup and dreamt of playing professionally themselves discovered that wasn't actually possible. When you're thrust out of your sport in your prime, what does it feel like?
You're a little displaced because I was 24 years old or whatever it was, and it just came to the point where it was like, okay, this soccer thing isn't going to pan out. It was awesome. I had a great experience, but I have to join the real world, and I have to think about my future. So I decided to go get a day job. Actually, my parents kind of like kicked my butt into getting a day job.
Doing what?
So I was a claims adjuster for the state of California for workers' comp insurance. My first day in the office, I mean, you're learning the job and you're doing all these classes and they're integrating you in, but like my first day in this like old school drab green cubicle, I seriously sat there and thought to myself, I can't die here. This is me. Like, I don't just phone it in. I knew that was not the end. I wasn't going to be a claims adjuster. I wasn't going to be in a cubicle the rest of my life.
As Erin filled out insurance forms, she also started drafting a new dream, something with the high-stakes rush she got playing in goal. And that new dream sounded like this. For 3 years, Erin worked at her cubicle, took night classes, passed the gamut of fitness tests, and waited for the call-up, which came in 2007. For the past decade, Erin Reagan has served as an L.A. County firefighter. Of the 4,000 firefighters in the county, 38 are women. A day in the life of a firefighter involves simple acts of helping, like fetching cats out of trees and unlocking cars, as well as more extreme duties, like wielding chainsaws on the roofs of burning buildings, cutting through shingles to provide an outlet for billowing smoke.
firefighting is, it's like, it's a team sport. And then also you get to be a hero, which is, I have a weird thing with being a hero.
In one of Aaron's first days on the job, she and her team got called to a burning building.
We had a fire like in a back bedroom, and we found a lady curled up, like kind of like in a pile of clothes. It was a little hard to see. And we dragged her out. It wasn't like Backdraft where you're carrying her over your shoulder and one person out of the thing. But like, that's what you sign up to do. Like, you want to be the one diving out of a building with two babies in your hands and save the world.
Diving on the field, diving out of a building, saving shots, saving lives. It wasn't that far of a jump. And the words of one of Aaron's old coaches were frequently on her mind, that an athlete who makes it to the top of the sport has a duty to give back to the game that has given her so much.
And he said, the way that you give back to the game is by teaching. That's how you repay.
Aaron has not stayed in soccer, but she has very much absorbed this lesson. With the other female firefighters, she created Girls Fire Camp, a program that gives 50-some teenage girls a chance to shadow real firefighters.
When we do our runs, so we run in formation, so we're all on the right foot at the same time and left foot, and you sing out your songs. And so I wrote a couple for the girls.
Do we get to hear one?
Well, it's like a call and response. So do you want to call?
Yeah, I can try.
Hey, Taylor Swift.
Hey, Taylor Swift.
You're in my head when I lift.
You're in my head when I lift.
Talking about how haters hate.
Talking about how.
Aaron Reagan is doing for this generation of girls what Mia Hamm and the 99 team did for her, expanded the notion of what's possible. Aaron helps the girls try on the 50 pounds of gear. They pull on the fireproof jacket and the heavy boots, and they walk around the fire station, considering, imagining, trying this life on for size.
That's Gwendolyn Oxenham. She's the author of Under the Lights and in the Dark, Untold Stories of Women's Soccer. That's where we first learned about Aaron Reagan. And the good news for girls today who hope to play professional soccer. The National Women's Soccer League began another season in March, and they have teams in Seattle, Chicago, Washington, and six other cities. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Thanks to Susan Ballett for field producing our story on Aaron Reagan. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Souza. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Aaron Reagan, the soccer goalie turned firefighter who studied art in college.
I'm a jack of all trades. I'm like every member of the Breakfast Club in one person.
Or maybe a Renaissance woman, because she studied art. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.